and the decision how long they stay should probably be divided between the judiciary and the parole board respectively, but simplified and clarified. This would probably take the form of a system where the trial judge in sentencing would simply say to the custody of the corrections division for a period of time as determined by law or something to that effect. And the parole board would then set the length of stay as it currently does. Thirdly, questions of facts, of data on the factors that affect the length of stay, the history risk, the crime severity, and the aggravating and mitigating circumstances should be subject to adversary process, preferably at the trial court level. This is because the interested parties are already there and because the goal of what we have in mind is to simplify. Creating another adversary hearing at a different level would complicate rather than simplify the system. Fourth, the judicial members of the Advisory Commission on Prison Terms and Parole Standards should prepare a set of guidelines on the indecision. These would be voluntary, perhaps, and subject to test and evaluation over the next biennium to determine whether or not they can work. I think one thing that can't be overemphasized is that many of the members of the Prison Overcrowding Project Policy Group feel very strongly that the single most important sentencing issue is that of policy in regard to the decision on who goes into prison. This is so basic that the crowding problem can't be adequately addressed until this aspect is thoroughly analyzed and addressed itself. To do that, we need full data on who goes to prison, how they get there, and the like. In summary, the directions that we're taking are that in Oregon, the decision policies in regard to in are at the heart of the sentencing structure issue, particularly from our perspective, which is that of the impact that sentencing has on prison population. That Oregon's current system is sound, a sound basis on which to build, despite obvious problems, many of which were raised by Steve Griffiths earlier today, the equity problems in particular. That solutions need to be adapted to Oregon conditions, preferences, values, and available resources, and need to be informed by the best and most thorough information available. And that a series of short-term changes may be able to address the most pressing problems while allowing for the kind of analysis necessary to support large-scale changes in the structure of sentencing in this state.
Thanks, Steve. Questions? Thank you, Stephen. We would hope that as more nearly final, more fine policy positions are resolved in the project, that I trust, assuming we're still here deliberating, that you'll share those with the committee as you're able to. Thank you very much. Mr. Gary?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I will make my remarks brief. I have submitted rather extensive written comments about both this bill and House Bills 2267 and 2268 because I believe that although they address the problem in a different way, they are obviously related. During the proceedings before the Task Force on Sentencing, during the interim, I appeared on behalf of the Department of Justice at numerous hearings and offered comments relating to many of the things that Mr. Griffith described as motivating House Bill 2087. Primarily among them was a shared concern about the need for increased truth in sentencing. The system that has, in fact, evolved since 1977, when the comprehensive reform first was initiated, is really a push-me-pull-you of determinate and indeterminate aspects. The parole board applies a matrix. the judge makes the in-out decision without any real guidelines, without any criteria to govern the exercise of that discretion. The judge has certain discretion to impose consecutive sentences for multiple offenses, whether they arise out of the same criminal episode or not. And the judge has, in some instances, a duty to impose mandatory minimums, in other instances, the discretion to impose a mandatory minimum. All of this leads to two basic problems. The first, identified by Mr. Griffith and other witnesses, is that the sentence imposed by the trial court bears little or no relationship to the time actually served. It is the view of the Department of Justice that until the system stops lying to the people about the consequences of criminal conduct, it is going to be impossible to restore credibility to the system, and it is going to be impossible to persuade the people in this state that there really is a need for additional correctional resources. A sentence imposed by a trial judge can be as high as 20, 40, 60, or 80 years for a criminal episode, and yet, particularly if the parole board elects to override consecutive sentences, that may translate into a sentence actually served of months. And when that offender is released from the institution, the anger and resentment and distrust of the public is focused on the parole board. I quite can understand why the sentencing judges would not want to have the task of imposing real-time sentences, because they have to stand for election. But until we start telling the people what the real consequences of criminal conduct are and what we can afford to do to a rapist or a burglar or a robber, we can really make very little progress toward a system that we all wish to see. Despite my sympathy with the overall objectives of House Bill 2087, the Department of Justice reluctantly must voice its opposition to the bill. I appreciate that there was an awful lot of hard work put into this bill by members of the task force, as well as by people who appeared and offered their advice and counsel and views. Nevertheless, for principally three reasons, we think that the bill is ill-advised. First of all, and I might add that Mr. Griffith has pointed out many of the problems with the bill, and in each of the ones that I'm going to mention, with the exception of one. The bill creates a commission on prison terms, severs part of the responsibility of the parole board, and in effect creates another level of bureaucracy in the sentencing process. We feel that that additional bureaucracy is unnecessary. We have no indication that the parole board has failed in its current responsibility to develop the matrix with advice and input from the Advisory Commission on Prison Terms. More importantly, as Mr. Griffith indicated, we believe there is a significant constitutional problem with creating a commission on prison terms, which is to fix the matrix, not merely advise on the matrix, when that commission on prison terms is to be comprised both of members of the judicial branch and members of the executive branch of government. I don't think really the problem is that members of the judicial branch would be held to be exercising an executive function when they sit on the commission. The problem is, regardless of whether the function of developing the matrix is characterized as an executive or a judicial or perhaps a legislative function, Article 3, Section 1 of the Oregon Constitution quite plainly states that members of one branch of government shall not perform functions that properly reside with another branch of government. Ultimately, a court would have to decide whether the fixing of the matrix is an executive function or a judicial function. It has to be one or the other. It can't be both. And therefore, having members of the judiciary on the Commission on Prison Terms, along with members of the executive, each having an equal vote, would have to fail under Article 3, Section 1. Our second concern relates to the significant limits which are placed upon the discretion of the sentencing judge in dealing with particularly aggravated conduct, and in particular with multiple offenses committed within the same criminal episode. Under current law, leaving aside the question of merger, a judge, when there are multiple offenses and particularly aggravated conduct, has the discretion to impose consecutive sentences even if the offenses arise out of the same criminal episode. The effect of the consecutive sentences is to stack the matrix. That's a fairly crude tool for aggravating sentences, I will concede, but it is a tool. House Bill 2087 would limit the ability to aggravate sentences to a total of 150% of the outer range of the matrix. Excuse me, 115%. Consequently, a person who today is convicted of rape, robbery, burglary, and kidnapping and receives consecutive sentences could get four times the matrix. Under House Bill 2087, he could get 15% more than the outer range of the matrix indicated time for the greater sentence. We're not suggesting that it is appropriate to stack the matrix four times or eight times or even two times in most cases, merely that there must be room within the system to deal with the most aggravated forms of conduct and to provide adequate protection for society. The current system provides that protection. It would particularly provide that protection if the anti-merger and some standards for consecutive sentences were passed. House Bill 2087, in our view, does not. Finally, there's been much discussion about where the fact-finding process ought to occur with respect to factors in aggravation and the facts necessary in order to apply the matrix. The matrix, as you are aware, involves facts surrounding the nature of the crime as well as facts surrounding the nature of the and background of the offender. I think as a matter of policy, it may well be desirable that those facts be found by the trial court at the time when the prosecutor is present, the defense attorney is present, and the facts are fresh in everyone's mind. There is a constitutional problem presented by doing that because of the Supreme Court's decision in State versus Wedge, which I believe is the decision that Mr. Griffith was referring to and could not recall the name of the case. Wedge involved the statute which provides for a mandatory minimum sentence when a person commits a crime while armed, while using or threatened to use a firearm. In Wedge, the Supreme Court held that the fact that the defendant used or threatened to use a firearm is a fact dealing with the nature of the offense, and as such, under the Oregon Constitution as construed in the previous decision of State versus Quinn, is a fact which must be found by the jury. In our view, by taking the fact-finding function regarding the nature of the offense from the parole board and putting it in the adjudicative process, albeit at sentencing, there is a serious question of whether State versus Wedge would require that those facts be found by the jury. Now, you can fix that merely by providing for special verdict forms, which I understand is the method that's used in California, but that seriously either protracts the jury fact-finding function or limits the kind of aggravating factors that you can consider in fixing the prison term as a practical matter. Those are our concerns. They're summarized in much greater detail in our written testimony.
Do you have has the department formulated a position yet on the proposal of Judge Hargraves? If you haven't, I will understand you haven't, since it isn't a formal measure at this point. But
I think that we don't have a formal position, but I will express a couple of concerns that we have. Since a principal objective of any reform ought to be truth in sentencing, I think that the Hargraves proposal just simply wouldn't accomplish that. The trial judge sentencing the defendant to a period of time in the custody of the Corrections Division and leaving it to the parole board to fix the sentence would leave the public without misinformation, as Mr. Griffith characterized it, but without any real information about what is going to happen to that individual. I think it's possible to simply have as a requirement the judge state at the time of sentencing what the parole matrix range is without having to impose that himself. And so at least then on the record it is known to the defendant and to the public. exactly what the parameters are that we're dealing with. Judge Hargreaves characterized truth in sentencing as letting elected officials fix the period of incarceration that they in their conscience believe is correct. We view truth in sentencing as telling the people how much time a person actually is going to do, and whatever factors may militate against imposing a sentence that the judge would prefer to impose really are beside the point. The public has to know what the consequences of criminal conduct are.
Well, do you think it's crucial whether or not that statement, even if it is only a reflection of what it is anticipated, at least the matrix would produce, that be made by the sentencing judge as opposed to issued, declared by the board at such time as that's resolved within the administration of the matrix by the board?
I think as a practical matter, for members of the public, and particularly when you're dealing with the most heinous kinds of crime that receive a lot of public attention, the sentencing proceeding is the end of the chapter, and a crime that occurs in Ashland is going to be well publicized in Ashland. The decision of the parole board may not be, and so I think it is important that the statement of what the range is be made at the time of sentencing rather than by the parole board later on.
But I take it, am I correct in understanding that you do you have a problem with the notion of eliminating the judge setting a maximum within the indeterminate range? Is that a different concern from the one of whether the anticipated effect of the matrix would be noted at the time of sentencing?
It is a different concern, I don't really know whether there's a problem with that. It limits the discretion, one of the three areas of discretion that the judge now has once he's made the in-out decision, which is to cap the matrix. And I'm not sure why it's desirable to do that, but I haven't really given that a lot of thought.
Further questions? I assume we'll be in constant discussion with you and the department as we work our way through this hearing. Thank you for the preparation of the statement.
Mr. Chairman, were we going to break for caucus at 4 o'clock?
No, but I'll excuse those who feel the need to
come. Well, I think I ought to maintain some semblance of a full committee for the purposes of taking this testimony, so wondering if that was your game plan or not.
No, unfortunately, we have. I want to get through all the bills today. I don't want to have to have people come back unnecessarily, Representative Smith. But if there's a need to be excused, just let me know.
Mr. Chair, I'm supposed to. I'm going to be carrying a bill that's going to be discussed in the caucus, and I need to sneak off and come back. I'll try to time.
Charles Jones, still have it?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Chalmers Jones. I'm a member of the Board of Parole, and I was also a member of the interim committee. And with that kind of background, my position here is a bit odd today since I'm speaking against the bill. However, I don't feel hypocritical because I filed a disclaimer at the time we voted to bring the recommendations out. And I based my feelings on the fact that we had worked vociferously for a considerable while and that the efforts of the group should, of course, be exposed to the deliberations of the legislature. However, my position here today is founded on my belief that with the passage of 2013 and 1977, the legislative body did a good job. And that legislation has been fine-tuned in the 79 session and again in the 1981 session. And I have yet to be able to understand the need for a radical change and a posture that was good in 77 and in my estimation has been good in the interim period, without even an in-depth analysis of what the results of 19 and 77 were. I know of no analysis that has taken place to determine that what the legislature did in 19 and 77 was in fact wrong. I can understand that some egos may have been bruised over the last 5 years, but that is a condition of living in this world. I think the parole board has done an adequate job. It has lived up to the mandates passed on to it by the legislative body, and I think we can continue to perform under the system now in place. No system is perfect. It is subject to changing times and circumstances, and from time to time does need a look-see, a fine-tuning, or an overhaul, if you will. But I think, again, 2013 was a good vehicle. I think the proposed legislation, while it changes some things, also complicates some things. I, in my own estimation, will think that when this legislation is costed out, it is going to be prohibitive. I am very conversant with the logistics of the system as it is now, and I have a reasonable idea of the logistics of the system proposed. And I can see the possibility right now that if not in fact each circuit court judge, at least each county is going to have to hire another person just to handle the kind of bag and baggage that goes with this proposed legislation. It brings about a lot of work in compiling, sorting out, and organizing information, and certainly the bench is not going to have time for that, and I know of no existing position in the judge's support group that can do that work. So I think a need has to be taken to look at a lot of this, because actually all we've done is dealt with getting the person to the penitentiary. And not too much discussion, nor interest has been focused on what happens after he gets there and what happens when he goes out. Well, we are conversant with that proposition. So for those few reasons that I've cited, and certainly there are others, I can see no basic need for a radical change in the way this system operates. I think it has been effective. I think it can continue to be effective. And if, in fact, it is not effective, that determination should be made after there has been some in-depth analysis of what has happened up to now. And again, I say that has not happened in the last 6 years. That would conclude my presentation, and if by chance there's a question, I would try to respond.
Thank you, Charles. Questions, please?
Thank you, Charles. As we go further in this area, we will be, of course, going into more detail as to how the board's role under the 77 legislation has been performing.
Surely, Mr. Chairman, I thank you for the opportunity to appear.
Thank you. Mr. Black?
Congressman, my name is Fred Black. I'm an attorney up there in Portland. I've done both defense work and prosecution work, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Council on Crime and Delinquency. And I was somewhat appalled to hear the suggestion of the way to handle this terrible situation is to simply bury it by sending all of the problems down to the parole board to handle. I think the Hargraves supposed solution is extremely dangerous. It doesn't provide for any type of attorney representation. It takes all the tremendous costs that you have up at the courtroom and simply supposedly takes them down to perhaps Salem to deal with.
I don't think I understood it to do that. The only change it would make in the present system, as I understand, is the judge would no longer set a maximum within the indeterminate range that could be served. That's the only change, I believe. Is it not?
I thought the idea was not to set a time at all, simply to put them in and allow the parole board to determine when they come out.
Well, that's what happens now, except apart from those cases where the judge specifies a minimum period, all his proposal does is simply eliminate the capping in effect by specifying a maximum.
Well, the scary thing about his proposal, the proposal is that's what we do have right now. And I think that the proposal is rather tongue-in-cheek to simply demonstrate how bad off we've gotten. In fact, at this time, the judges no longer determine the sentence at all. We have no real control over the overcrowding situation that we have in the prisons, and we have no real control over the costs that are associated with that overcrowding. I think the Oregon Council on Crime and Delinquency has spent quite a bit of time looking at this proposal, and we like the direction that the bill is heading in that it does provide for some type of truth in sentencing, and I think that everybody that's spoken here is concerned with that, whether you follow the Hargraves solution or something else. Everybody's concerned, and this is perhaps one of the most important bills dealing with criminal law that must have been before this representative committee. Seems that until we can start to somehow grapple with truth in sentencing and express some kind of concern for the prison overcrowding in the sense that we can get control over it, that all we have is a problem that everybody's pointing to and trying to find solutions to. The 2087 bill does provide for a matrix which would be determined by a commission, not simply the parole commission. It would be more representative than what we have now, in that there would be six judges and there would be other representatives of from the parole commission and one from the defense bar and one layperson, and so that it would be a more representative group, and we'd have judges involved with it at least. That's better than what we have at the present time. And it would take into account, as part of that guidelines, the present capacity of the prisons. We have nothing at this time that takes into account the limited resource that we have in corrections. A judge, when he gives a sentence, it may be partly the sentence may be partly due to an election coming up, or it may be partly due to the variety of sentencing is amazing. We have some people that get years for very limited crimes, and other people that some judges take into consideration the overcrowding. Some judges don't take them into consideration at all. We like the direction that the bill is heading simply because it begins to grapple with some of the problems that haven't been grappled with up till now. The idea of shifting any of this any more to the parole commission is simply a cover-up, something that's not seen. You don't have to worry about it. We just march these people off to jail that are convicted of crimes. Don't worry about providing them with an attorney. If you've ever tried to represent a client in front of the parole commission, they have very limited due process guarantees. Usually you get your 5 minutes of hearing and a decision is made. And so basically the proposal, I regard the Hargraves proposal as simply a cover-up or simply an illustration of what we presently already have. We would like to propose some specific modifications to the bill as it's presently before this committee. One is that it overly restricts the commission, the suggested commission. Page 3 of the bill, in paragraph 5, proposes to limit the commission as to what that matrix would be. It would seem that that defeats the purpose of having a commission and having them make responsible decisions as to what that matrix should be. And therefore, the bill as it presently stands on page 3 is overly restrictive. Also, I think that that each commission member should be appointed rather than elected. The judges would be a poll of the judges. We would suggest that instead of a poll of the judges, that they be appointed by the Supreme Chief Judge of the Supreme Court, and also that instead of a poll of the district attorneys, that the Attorney General would appoint the district attorney. We think that an appointive process provides a more rational, if the intent is to provide a workable and rational solution through the appointive process, one would probably guarantee that better. Also, on page 3, there's language that the court can simply disregard these matrix, this matrix, if they choose. If you have that kind of language, if you do not make it mandatory, you simply do not have anything new whatsoever. And you haven't begun to solve the overcrowding problem because the judges on a uniform basis could simply disregard it every time it it comes up. Also, on page 3, there's some lip service played to taking into account prison resources. We think that it should be mandatory that the resources are taken into account. Otherwise, you've passed a bill that simply doesn't correct the problem, doesn't take into account the costs involved